You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Support for today's show comes from Citizen. Isn't it time you saw the light? Citizen makes watches that are powered by light, any light, and will never need a battery. So stay on time with Citizen's collection of Echo Drive watches. They're for just about everyone who prefers to be on time. Visit citizenwatch.com/podcast for more. That's citizenwatch.com/podcast. If you're an entrepreneur, a small business owner, or even if you have a side gig, let me introduce you to Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. Grasshopper lets you send and receive calls and texts from your new business phone number. That way, you can run your business from anywhere and respond to clients quickly with Grasshopper's mobile apps. Grasshopper, sign up today. Go to grasshopper.com/kick to get $20 off your first month. That's grasshopper.com/kick. And now, enjoy the podcast.
I wasn't aware that I had offended.
Jesus didn't want our suffering. He suffered for us. Mm-hmm. He wants our commitment and our obedience.
Mm-hmm. And what of his creation? The heavens declare the glory of God. God is present everywhere in every plant, every river, every tiny insect. The whole world is a manifestation of his holy presence. I think this is an issue where the church can lead, but they say nothing. The U.S. Congress still denies climate change. Where were we when these people were elected?
Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. That was Academy Award-nominated actor Ethan Hawke as a solitary middle-aged parish pastor with a dwindling congregation in a dramatic and thought-provoking new film called First Reformed. Still mourning the death of his son and the loss of his marriage, he finds himself plunged into his own tormented past and equally despairing future in a crisis of faith that is at once personal, political, and planetary. The film, written and directed by the legendary Paul Schrader, was a favorite at this year's Venice Film Festival and has a 98% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes, with many comparing Ethan Hawke's performance to that of Robert De Niro as Travis Bickle in Schrader's early classic Taxi Driver. And today, Ethan Hawke joins me on the podcast for a wide-ranging conversation covering art, politics, spirituality, the environment, and more. He describes working with Robin Williams on Dead Poets Society, why he says he finds more creative fulfillment in music than acting, and what he calls the spiritual marriage between an actor and director. He opens up about his own spiritual journey, his admiration for the work of Thomas Merton, his thoughts on the social responsibility of religious leaders, and his skepticism of megachurches that preach prosperity. Plus, Ethan talks about what he calls the velocity of depression, why he's not afraid to take long breaks from the silver screen, his work with the YMCA to help kids overcome tribalism and find common ground in the modern age, and his upcoming project about our favorite mad scientist, Nikola Tesla. Coming up with Ethan Hawke in just a moment. In his 30-year career, he's received 4 Oscar nominations and starred in more than 75 films, including Dead Poets Society, Reality Bites, Training Day, the Richard Linklater trilogy, Before Midnight, Before Sunrise, and Before Sunset, Maudie, Boyhood, and now his latest film from Paul Schrader called First Reformed. Ethan Hawke, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I really don't think it's been 75 films, by the way.
Oh, really?
It's maybe 62 or something like that. But I have a theory. When I was a kid, I saw William Holden give one of these kind of interviews, and they asked him, how does he choose his parts? And he said, I just do every movie I can. 1 in 10 will be good, and 1 in 100 will get you an Academy Award. And so I think that, hopefully it is 75.
I mean, in some ways, you must probably envy him because, you know, those were still the studio days when it's kind of like you didn't have to read every script and think about these things.
Just
you kind of had someone who was thinking about your career.
Do what John Ford says and keep moving.
Yeah. We like to criticize the old way and how, you know, it was easy to get pigeonholed and typecast, but Humphrey Bogart was totally typecast.
Yeah, I mean, but he did great
Clark
parts.
Clark Gable, typecast.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I didn't even include all the plays that you've done, documentaries, novels. I mean, it's been a lot that you've fit into, what, the past 30 years now, I guess?
Well, what's the George Bernard Shaw line? I want to be thoroughly used up when I come to die. You know, I remember I saw that quote. I was like, yeah, man, me too.
Yeah, and I think it's coming up on, what, 30 years since Dead Poets? Is it this year or next year, which was your breakout film, of course, right?
Well, you're right. I started filming Dead Poets Society 30 years ago this October.
Wow.
That's amazing. So that means, which I never really thought, but that's like Explorers was 35 years ago. So that's pretty intense.
Was that your first movie?
That was my first
part. So it wasn't Dead Poets.
No, my first part, I was 13 years old, and I was with River Phoenix and Jason Preston, and we built our own spaceship.
Right.
But that was an anomaly in my life. I had kind of gone on that audition as a lark and hadn't meant to be a child actor or anything. And so I did the movie. The movie was a bomb, and nobody cared about it. And then I went back to high school. And when I graduated high school, I went to theater school, and then I went and auditioned for Dead Poets Society.
Now, we were just talking before we went on mic about Robin Williams, and I was telling you I just started this amazing new biography about him and how he was so tortured emotionally and also just physically. Like I said, he was misdiagnosed and had Parkinson's and all this stuff. What was he like, or did you really get much of a window as a young kid working with him?
Well, I mean, he got me my first agent, that experience.
Really?
It was my first, I would say, in all honesty, my first experience with what acting could be. There's a scene in Dead Poets Society where he writes in the blackboard, I sound my barbaric yawp over the rooftops of the world. Mr. Anderson doesn't think he has anything of value inside him. Isn't that right, Mr. Anderson? You know, and the scene went on from there. And it's a scene where I'm supposed to recite a poem in front of the class. And there was a feeling, it was, you know, I wouldn't be exaggerating to say, I wouldn't have said this at the time, but it was something transcendent about acting with him. There were a lot of young men in that room that I admired, Josh Charles and Robert Sean Leonard, and James Waterston, all the guys from the movie. And we were learning about acting together. And it was a very big scene. And, you know, when you shoot a scene like that, it takes all day. And the Steadicam was new. The cam, you know, this, never really, you know, Steadicams had just started. This idea that we're going to float around the room with the Steadicam, which actually involves everybody because nobody's sure when they're going to be on frame. And so everybody, and there starts to be this collective imagination thing that happens.
Yeah, that's true.
And it was a magical scene. I remember when the day was over, it's a little bit like I often hear drug addicts say, it's like that first hit, that's all I wanted to do ever again. And I haven't stopped. And it's connected to Robin. You know, I mean, that was my first touching of what the possibilities of acting are, which is actually transcending yourself. They make this big deal about acting like it's the cult of personality or like you're fabulous because people see these award shows and walking around. But of course, acting at its best, you're actually leaving yourself behind in this wonderful way and being in service of a story, and that story goes on to impact other people and impact their lives. And it begins to be this light at its best that shows how our experiences are not nearly as unique as we think they are. Especially when we're suffering, you know, we think our experience is so unique and our pain is so unique.
Yeah.
And yet we're surrounded by sisters and brothers and people have feeling the same.
Yeah, in fact, I think that I heard you say at this year's Sundance that you feel like there's a certain spirituality to acting. What did you mean by that?
When I was younger, I would turn down a part because the character had a British accent. I was very interested in the truth, and I didn't want anything between me and the camera. I didn't want a fake voice. I didn't want fake hair. I wasn't interested in, like, I wasn't interested in the kind of acting that usually gets prizes, like, you know, he's got a big nose and he's got big red hair and he's got a limp and he's pretending to have a brain aneurysm or something. I was very interested in real life and regular life and the truth and the non-drama. That's why Richard Linklater was this amazing partnership to find.
Oh, yeah.
I was the perfect actor for him, and because it was really what I was blurring the line between performer and character was something that was very interesting to me. But as I've gotten older, I've realized that what I think of as myself, me, the attributes of my personality. You asked this question, all right, buddy. So I decided to answer it.
That's all right. I feel like I'm with the Dalai Lama now.
No, you're not. When I've had four kids and you hold them when they're born, there's an essence to them that you actually recognize as they get older. There's this essence to my older. She's turning 20 in a month. And I reckon who is her, she, this person, Maya, was present in that infant. And I couldn't have told you what that was, but I recognize it as it's grown. But it's not what clothes she wears, and it's not the affectations of her voice, and it's not whether she decides to be a vegetarian or whether she decides to be a Trump supporter. There's an essence to her that is beyond all these labels that we come up with. And one of the amazing things about acting is that you can wear the accoutrements of personality a little bit like clothes, in that how my voice is not the essence of me. It's the essence of where I'm from and the people I've been surrounded by or the experiences I've had. But you start, and so there's, if you see where I'm answering here, which is that there's something spiritual about this, which is you're getting at what is the essence of all of us, what is changeable, what is unchangeable. And it's a very, very interesting question. And it's something that I find when people offer me parts or things like that, I'm not looking necessarily. I mean, there's been times in my life where I've looked for a job that will pay my bills or something. But really, I'm looking for things that are pushing me in my relationship to my work that helps my life be more interesting.
So you feel that acting kind of taps you into the greater society at large or the subconscious of the culture.
I'm saying it its best it can.
Yeah. And of course, this is a film that deals with spirituality. I'm talking about your latest film, First Reformed. You work with one of the great directors, Paul Schrader, who, of course, was a real legend and instrumental in the new wave cinema of the 70s, Taxi Driver, American Gigolo, Raging Bull. Is this your first time working with him?
It is, yeah.
I once heard that you said that your favorite quote was by Marlon Brando, and he said something along the lines that acting in a movie is a little bit like spiritually marrying your director. So what was Paul like as a spiritual spouse? Was it a honeymoon, a rocky marriage, a little bit of both?
Paul is a bull.
Yeah.
You know, he's a giant bull. And one of the things that happens when you work with him, or what happened to me, is it's the first time in a little while where I felt really excited to get older. He's incredibly wise, and we've had this thing in our culture of devaluing experience, and we kind of have put this huge value on a beauty aesthetic, or we've put a huge, and Paul actually is deeply knowledgeable about cinema. And I start to realize how many phonies I've worked with. People who, this guy, you know, Transcendental Style and Film, he knew more in 1971 about film than I know now. And he's been dead. And that was before he worked with Scorsese. And before he wrote Last Temptation of Christ. We're talking about. And here's the other interesting thing that I find for young people. He's also failed a lot. One of the things that I admire about him is his career hasn't been about money. You know, a lot of guys who get successful, they start trapping themselves in money. They want fancy tools. They want things to be easy. Paul has never wanted anything to be easy. He's an angry young man who's now in the body of a 70-something-year-old who is actually deeply wise. And so when I read the script for First Reformed, it's clearly the same voice that wrote Taxi Driver.
Oh, yeah.
It's just a wiser... The sword is a lot sharper and therefore can move a lot slower and more meticulously.
Mm-hmm.
And it really made me excited to continue to grow up.
Yeah, and this film bookends nicely with Taxi Driver, I think.
It does, yeah.
You know, a lot of the audience time in this movie is spent inside the mind of your character, this pastor who experiences a similar sense of despair and isolation as Travis Bickle does in Taxi Driver. Was this something that you and Paul were conscious of while you were making the movie?
You know, when you're making the movie, you can't really be reviewing it.
Yeah.
and thinking about it. I mean, I would make jokes sometimes like, you know, there's a little Travis Bickle in this line, isn't there? You know, or something like that. And you go, maybe so, you know. And what we were trying to do is create something new. And when you're working with a guy who's in his 70s, who's extremely accomplished and worked a lot, it's not going to be new. You're building on, you know, Kurt Vonnegut doesn't just write a new novel. It speaks to his whole body of work. I mean, if he was alive, you mean but you understood where I was going with that.
Exactly. And it's building on what came before.
And
his experience also as a director.
And a great writer, whether it's Sam Shepard or Tom Stoppard or whoever you have, they have their themes, right? I mean, there's a certain consistency to a good writer that's valuable.
Yeah. And I know that Paul Schrader was, I think, raised a Calvinist. Mm-hmm. That was his religious background.
Grand Rapids, Michigan, yeah.
This film deals with a lot of that. He's very well acquainted with the particular type of church and pastor that you're portraying in First Reformed. But what about you? Are you a particularly religious person? Or were you at some point?
It's always a dangerous question because... whenever people start talking too much about their inner life, I always get worried they're going to try to convert me or something.
Yeah.
You know, it makes me very nervous. Yeah. I will answer that question, but you know, Paul really does know a lot about the life of faith. He didn't see a movie until he was about 20, you know, I mean, he was studying religion and an amazing moment on set where I had to, I'm playing this priest and I'm conducting a funeral service. I'm supposed to be reading this passage from the Bible and giving my little sermon and there at this toxic waste dump. It's a kind of great scene. And I'm preparing and Paul runs over and says, "Hey, he takes the prop Bible out of my hand and hands me this other Bible. And this Bible is very careworn. And I open it up and it says, Merry Christmas, Paul, 1956, Grand Rapids, Michigan, love mom and dad, you know?
Oh, wow.
And I open it, I turn the passage, and it's his Bible.
His Bible. Wow.
You know? And it was a very powerful moment for me because I realized how important this movie was inside of him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I was actually inside his... creative energy, you know, as it were. It's very, and of course, we did the scene cut and he ripped it out of my hand. I knew I was going to love the script when early on my character talks about his relationship to Thomas Merton. Because Thomas Merton is a Catholic monk, was a Catholic monk. He died in 1968. And he's a very beautiful writer. And he was incredibly impressive because of his openness to other religions and other philosophies, and his viewpoint on Christian mysticism is very exciting. And his definition of God is illuminating and not restrictive. And I found his journals throughout my life to be a source of inspiration. In fact, you know, one of the things... nobody would be interested in hearing this in the slightest, but one of the things I think as a young man that I found so powerful about his journals is that he really felt he had to choose between writing and the religious life. That if he was serious about his religious life, he would give up his ambitions as a writer.
Interesting.
And you in his journals, you really hear him at war with this struggle. And what happens is it launches him into being one of the great Catholic writers of his generation. And I was reading this at a time when I was trying to decide whether I wanted to be a writer or an actor. And I really saw them as at war with each other. And I, through these journals, really realized that integration of the self is what you're looking at. You don't want to banish one side of yourself or only fan the flames of this other. That really what you end up getting from his life's journey is that we can be a whole self. And so, I don't know, Thomas Merton has been very important to me and my faith. And, you know, I was baptized, confirmed, all that stuff. And it's gone through different periods of my relationship to it.
Right. Well, any thinking person probably does over the course of their mm-hmm. life. And it's interesting when you talk about Thomas Merton, because that comes into it in the film. You mm-hmm. see this contrast between yourself, who is a more traditional Calvinist preacher, and you are a theologian and interested in reading and mm-hmm. writing, and almost in a rabbinical way, mm-hmm. you know, interested in the intellectual debate mm-hmm. of religion. And you see that juxtaposed with a man who's sort of your mentor, sort of a mm-hmm. benefactor, played by Cedric the Entertainer, who is one of these mega church prosperity mm-hmm. pastors at a church called, I think it's Abundant Life. Mm-hmm. Which is perfect because that's the buzzword these days, abundance, which yeah. is another word for, you know, ask for whatever you want, and whatever you want is going to be immediately given to you if you just pray and believe.
As if the answer to anything was ever to get more. We keep pretending yeah. the answer is that we want more.
Yeah.
There's a great documentary coming out. I participated in briefly, but it's about Elvis, and it kind of uses the life of Elvis to parallel the life of America from the 50s to now, and kind of comparing basically that Elvis in his fat suit, unable to take a D on the toilet, you know, dying is basically Trump in the White House. You know, that's yeah. basically what we started as a country. We started after the war as this kind of innocent, truly spiritual, you know, beauty, right? Mm-hmm. And then pinched off the soul of the African American community, stole their suffering, stole their music. Yeah, and made a ton of money, and then kind of got bought by the army and started acting like that's what we were all about. And then before you know it, we're fat and pimped out and addicted to drugs. And that's where we are now.
Yeah, you seem to have a real interest in music alongside your acting and writing. I mean, you have this other film that you directed and mm-hmm. wrote as well called Blaze, and they kind of went to all the same festivals, it seems, alongside uh-huh. each other, both to great critical praise. That one, I think it follows Blaze Foley, a country mm-hmm. musician. You played Chet Baker not mm-hmm. that long ago in a film. You did this documentary on the pianist Seymour Bernstein. Yeah. Do you play an instrument? Do you consider yourself a very musical person? Because it seems to be a significant part of your life, I guess.
You know, that's a very good question. I've thought about where is all this coming from myself. Yeah. And I think part of it has to do with when I started acting, it was a real passion. I loved it. And slowly, I still love it. But it's now how I pay for my kids' education. It's how I pay my rent. It's how I pay my child support. It's how I fix the toilet. It's how I pay for a vacation. And it's a little bit a job.
Yeah.
It's something I take great pride in. And what it's done is it sits on top of my love, but it's pretty heavy. You know, and music is a place where there's nothing sitting on top of it anymore. And I think that some part of my brain is trying to find another art form. Mm-hmm. Where there's no worry attached to it. Mm-hmm. I don't know about you, but there's
that makes sense.
So much anxiety to adult life. Like am I gonna afford that? But do I care about money too much? Not enough? Yeah. What's the balance?
But I feel like this generation, or not just millennials, but people over the past 30 years seem to put this huge expectation on themselves that if they're not 100% satisfied by their job, specifically by their job, then there's something wrong with them.
But I look at a lot of the women that I'm friends with, and somehow the culture has put them in this position where it's almost impossible to be happy. You're supposed to be a great mom. You got to be a great mom, right? Or else you're just a total loser.
Yeah, you're a failure.
But you also better have a career or else you're just a housewife, right? And that's not cool. So you got to be a great mom and you have to have a great career. And also, by the way, you better be smoking hot, all right? And so get to the gym, right? And you better have a great relationship with your husband, but not be defined by him, right? And you're starting to create this situation for to be happy. You need to have everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a recipe to be absolutely miserable, because what it does, I think it creates this feeling in all of us men too, of just coming up short all the time. Well, I didn't get to go to the gym and I'm not really as good at my career as I want to. And I'm not as good a parent as I want to. And I do like, it creates this feeling of, you know, that terrible feeling like when you're treading water and you feel like you're losing, like, I'm alive right now, but I think in 35 seconds I'll be drowning.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Ethan Hawke when we come back in just a minute. Hey, folks, I recently had a huge milestone in my life. I decided to ask my girlfriend to marry me, and when I did, I turned to Adiamore.com for the perfect engagement ring. I shopped around, both online and in person, and no one beat Adiamore.com for the best price and the best quality. I even met with Sam, the owner of Adiamore, and I've never met anyone who knows more about diamonds and jewelry. That's because his family's been in the jewelry business since 1950. Eventually, I decided on a stunning 3-carat oval stone in a beautiful 3-stone trillion setting, and my new fiancé was thrilled. Visit adiamore.com/kick and browse their huge selection of diamonds. You can go on their site and try different diamonds with different settings until you come up with the perfect ring for you or the woman you love. All of Adiamore's diamonds are GIA certified, and their rings come with a lifetime guarantee against material defects. Plus, Adiamore even gives you 30 days to evaluate the deal and make sure that you're 100% happy with your purchase. That's because the folks at Adiamore know that once you find a jeweler you can trust, you've got a jeweler for life, and you'll keep coming back year after year. But look, don't take my word for it. Check out Adiamore's reviews on Yelp. So do yourself a favor. If you're shopping for an engagement ring or a gift, even if you may think you're going to go somewhere else, before you purchase, you owe it to yourself to click on adiamore.com/kick, look at their selection, and compare. That's Adiamore, adiamore.com/kick. Their quality and prices speak for themselves, and my fiancé and I couldn't be happier. And now, back to the podcast. One of the things that's always been interesting about you is you're not afraid to step away from it for a while, take a break from films for a year, or some cases, I think at some points, even 2 years. Mm-hmm. Most actors are terrified that, you know, if when they finally decide to come back to it a year or two later, their agent won't return the call or they won't be getting scripts. People forget about them. How do you not have that kind of anxiety?
Well, I do, first of all. And second of all, I've also been incredibly blessed with, you know, every life has its, you know, we all get dealt our cards or whatever, but I've had, you know, I was in Dead Poets Society when I was 18, and that opened a lot of doors for me and, and created a lot of freedom. And what I try to do is use whatever modicum of success I have to create more freedom in my life. What I see happen to so many of my friends or people I know is that you start getting successful or, you know, perceived successful, and then that makes you feel like you just have to be more successful or else you've somehow failed. And one of the great things about the arts is that it's not defined by money. Almost every other job, you know, like we always turn everything into a sporting event, but you know how, what kind of year you have by how much money you made this year. Well, some of my best creative years, I didn't make any money. You know, Allen Ginsberg never made more than 17 grand. He's the defining poet of his generation. Do you know? So you can't use money as a barometer for success in this profession of the arts. You just can't. It's fundamentally flawed. I mean, in fact, most of the people that make a lot of money on the arts are definitely not doing anything interesting. You know, it's pretty much, you know, Linklater got nervous when Boyhood was such a success. Well, maybe it's not as good a movie as I thought. No, that's just a joke. But you know what I mean is that it's like, Oh, I think you do know what I mean.
I get what you're saying. And I want to sort of relate this back to the film here. Because in First Reformed, you play this pastor who has both lost his son. His son died in a war that he encouraged him to go fight in.
I was a military chaplain. Yeah. I encouraged him to.
And your wife has left you. So your character sort of has either the luxury or the curse of being alone with his thoughts a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes him to some pretty dark places. As a guy with four kids and a lot of projects on your plate, do you subscribe to the idea that too much time to think can be a bad thing, or do you spend a lot of time in your head?
Yeah, well, you know, idle hands, idle mind. And
yeah.
I always have this thing that I've noticed in my life is that loneliness perpetuates itself.
Mm-hmm.
And depression does too.
Yeah.
There's a certain velocity to loneliness and depression where it actually feels good to feel bad. It feels comfortable, at least. And it's the same way I think that people get involved in abusive relationships, like their father beat them and now that relationship feels familiar and feels like love. And in my life, the time periods I've been the most lonely or the most depressed, there have been avenues to break out of it that I didn't want to take. And looking back on it, I don't know why, but I think it has a certain velocity to it. You start to want to go down the rabbit hole, you know, and the darkness kind of does start to call you. And I do find working in helps engage you with other people. You know, it's so corny, but you know, my mother used to always say this to me when I was 19, 20, 21 and stuff. I'd get really depressed and she'd just say, "Have you exercised?" You know, and I'm like, "Oh, mom, that's ridiculous." And then as I get older, I find myself saying the same thing too. Like, if you engage with the world, it does help break the spell.
Yeah.
Before you know it, I'm going to sound like some kind of 89-year-old spinster grandma. Kids, make sure you get sleep.
Yeah, but I think that you're onto something. I do think that there is something to be said for this idea that if you spend too much time in that dark place, it can become your norm, and then you're afraid to break
free.
Exactly.
And look what happens to Reverend Toller, my character. Mm-hmm. He's the movie on page one. He's lost his son and lost his wife, right? Yeah. And his wife basically left him because he guided his son into the military, and his son, you know, died in Iraq. And here he is alone in this parish where it's only known for its relationship to the past. It was a parish that's famous for being part of the Underground Railway. And what I find so brilliant about that from a text place is that we all look around and go, and you see some environmental terrorist. Let's say there's some guy who's going to go lay down in front of the trucks cutting down the rainforest or something and get killed, or somebody's going to blow themselves up for South Dakota, Standing Rock, you know, like part of this, you know, we, who wants to go set themselves on fire to stop that?
I mean, it does seem that religion today is divorced from the kind of advocacy that, say, Jesus would have had back in his time.
We see that person as a radical, as a freak. And yet we look at people who worked for the Underground Railroad and the people who risked their lives, who were seen as radical freaks of their day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people who are willing to die to stop injustice, something that we all know is unjust.
Yeah.
And so Reverend Toller's sitting there in this parish all by himself, thinking about the Underground Railway and having this young man come to him and saying, "Why are we letting the planet catch on fire? What are you doing about it?" You know, meanwhile, people are yelling at him for, you know, letting the choir sing a Neil Young protest song, and you start to get angry. I mean, it's brilliantly scripted, you know, and
I mean, he's such a fascinating character. And I feel like society today doesn't allow for that type of duality, the potential for serious philosophical thought like that.
We're allergic to non-dual thinking. You know, the whole kind of, it's what's happened. I mean, it's how Trump got elected, right?
Yeah.
Is that we all became so tribal. I mean, I think it's been fascinating that we became so tribalistic that we didn't really debate issues anymore. You're either on one team or another team.
Right.
And now this snake oil salesman can kind of come in and take advantage of this great hole. It was fascinating watching Barbara Bush's funeral and seeing the elegance and dignity with which the Bush family carries themselves and realizing that, wow, the left used to have a problem with these guys. This guy, George Bush, had on his desk, to whom much is given, much is asked. You know, that used to be on his desk. And what do we have? We have now is like a guy trying to sell his hotels. Yeah. I mean, it's like we've fallen. because, and I really think about this, I think it's really interesting because in my generation, I've seen this. When I was a little kid, you would watch, I remember George H. Bush talking about Jimmy Carter as one of the finest Christians he'd ever met. Do you know?
Yeah.
I remember Tip O'Neill, who was a Democratic Speaker of the House, saying that he didn't agree with Ronald Reagan, but damn, what a hell of a man. You know? And I remember we've come so far from that. And I think my grandfather would say that the reason why those guys could see the left and the right in not such adversarial positions is because of World War II, because they had all served together. You may be, you know, for the NAACP, and I may not be feeling that, but we all fought the fascists.
Yeah.
And so they would have that together. And as we've grown further and further away from that, we even see that some people prefer the Russians to Hillary Clinton, and they really feel that way.
Yeah.
And that's really true for them. But we've come a long way. And it's interesting to me that kind of tribalistic thinking has gotten us away from being an issue-based democracy, you know?
Yeah, and one of the things that I love about this movie is that it touches on a lot of this in very subtle ways. It's about so much more than just the plot of the film. It gets into society and politics, and there's certainly, you see in these mega churches and in the Cedric character, you see a reflection of society as a whole where people don't want to be told something's hard. They don't want to be told that they may have to retrain or move to find a new job. They just want someone to tell them, hey, I'm going to bring back your coal jobs, and tell them what they want to hear. It doesn't matter whether
it's
true or not.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah. At some point, I think a few years ago, I read you say that you prefer great art over politics, which you said shows how little you care about the latter. Since 2016, at least from what I'm hearing from you right now, I'm assuming that you feel a lot more politically engaged than you did in 2012.
I do, but I also stand by that sentence, you know, that I also think that great art is good politics. What bad art is left or right. Do you know what's beautiful about First Reformed is it doesn't have an agenda about how you vote. It's not trying to tell you that you need to be more environmentally conscious. It's trying to talk about a crisis that's happening right now in our world that we don't know how to feel about.
Yeah.
It's giving voice to a situation. It's not telling you how to think about it. I don't like some movie that's trying to that's not about telling the truth.
Yeah.
You know, it does seem that our political voices need to be heard, because a lot of times, unfortunately, the most angry, like take the Christian community, for example. I grew up a Christian and I am a Christian. And some of the most radical, unintelligent members of the Christian community get the megaphone. There's a lot of enlightened Christian thinkers and scholars and workers in this country, a lot of whom are African American, a lot of whom are that don't have the loudspeaker. Big money has the loudspeaker, right? Mm-hmm. And big money gives certain people that facilitate their agenda the loudspeaker.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, how the evangelical movement is talking about building a wall is kind of beyond me. I don't understand. Yeah. I even read the New Testament. I'm not sure Jesus wasn't really about building walls. It's kind of, I find it fascinating. You know, blessed are the greedy, blessed are the self-promoters.
Yeah.
Blessed are the rich.
Yeah, exactly. Evangelicals for porn stars now, suddenly. Yeah. You know, come on.
But you know, you can do the same thing to the left. It's amazing how much people who supported Bill Clinton through his Monica Lewinsky things want to jump on the porn star thing.
Yeah.
And yet,
exactly.
And it's also amazing that the people who were, you know, the Ken Stars of the universe who were attacking Bill Clinton seem to not care about the Stormy Daniels. It shows what hypocrites we are.
Yeah.
And it that's what bothers me most on both. And that's why it's like, you've got to get rid of both these sides and start. That's why why Jimmy Carter and George H. Bush are a great example to us, because they're men who carried themselves with dignity and who you honestly believe when they went to bed at night really were trying to do good for the country. You may not have agreed with how they did it, but you know, they weren't trying to sell their daughter's shoes. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you just, you know, and so it's whatever side of the argument, we all use arguments against each other, but not for each other.
Yeah. And one thing that really interested me is apparently you've been working with the YMCA to get kids to kind of come together and overcome that sort of tribalism as well.
I kind of believe that, you know, the Y is a kind of amazing organization because I've started to know it because I travel a lot. So I'm always, you know, I'm in Atlanta shooting a movie and I'm in Seattle doing a play and I'm doing a thing in LA. And there's always a Y that you can go work out in. And you see, I take my son and I go play basketball there, and it's one of these places at the Y in New Mexico. We got to play basketball with all the kids coming off the res, you know, and the Y in Chicago is different. You know, it's you meet all these different, and
it's not an elitist institution. Yeah, everyone has a Y.
Everyone has a
Y
in there. Everybody likes to work out. Everybody likes to be healthy.
Yeah.
And everybody doesn't like it when you steal their basketball. And you know what I mean? Yeah. And so I realized that we need more organizations in an institutional level that let us be together. Because unfortunately, these, you know, when they talk about red states and blue states and stuff like that, what that means is we're all actually not talking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a fascinating thing in my family where we were together. We were with my brother and his family. And he has a 15-year-old daughter and I have a 15-year-old son. And it was the day of the Charlottesville riots.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really interesting because I said something like, oh, I just wish they'd tear those statues down. And my niece was really angry at me and passionate about why history was so important to her. And she's grown up on military basis and the rewriting of history, she was completely opposed to. And my son went talking about, well, what do you mean? Why is there only one history? Why and why in, you know, my son's single, why in Berlin do they have statues of Rommel? You know, exactly. Does Goebbels have a statue?
I mean, guy, it's illegal.
This guy tried to end the United States of America, you know, Robert E. Lee, Jefferson Davis. This guy really fought and killed other Americans to encourage his right to be able to enslave another part of our population.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about it all day long, and we ended up listening to the mayor of Louisiana's speech. He gave us a beautiful speech about
Mitch Landrieu.
And we were all, the whole family's on different sides. And by the end of the night, everybody realized that they'd never even heard an intelligent argument from the other point of view. That all, you know, if you're watching Fox News, you only hear X. And if you're watching CNN, you only hear Y.
Yeah.
And so what I realized, what was upsetting to my niece, is she thought that if I thought X, that meant I hated her.
Yeah.
And that to me showed me where we're at. That we're not even talking about issues here. We don't disagree. Yeah. We're engaged in a position, in maintaining a position.
Yeah, I had someone the other day who was saying that we need to have more spaces for connectivity or opportunities of connection.
And I started thinking, you know what? The why is this. And the movies are. Why I said that thing about politics and art. The movies are a place where you shouldn't go and be preached to about your politics. This is about our lives and telling our stories and sharing our stories.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
We got to share our stories. And that's how I learn from your story. You learn from mine and we make sense out of the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and that's how you get to the point of, you know, being able to have intellectual conversations and question things in your mind when you get out of the dogma, when you can separate yourself from that.
Yeah. And you can be wrong and you can think about things from a new way.
Yeah. Well, before we go, I'm kind of a science nerd, so I have to ask about the Nikola Tesla biopic you're doing. Any word on when we can expect that? And what's your take on our favorite mad scientist?
Well, I don't know. I've just begun thinking about it, really.
Okay.
But we're hopefully going to shoot this fall. And, you know, I'm fascinated about how history works and how the Edison-Tesla competition, how history really remembers Edison and history has forgotten Tesla. But now Tesla is reemerging and people are, you know, this case to be made, you could give Tesla the credit for the internet. And there's he's a really brilliant man. And I think a deeply lonely person, and I find loneliness, like we talked a little about, I find it really interesting. And certain, but it, not to bring it right back to where it began, not unlike Robin Williams, you know, genius is an overused word, but I might say that Robin is the only genius I've ever worked with, meaning he just really wasn't like anyone else. His brain didn't function the way anybody else I know.
Yeah.
And it was a great, great burden.
Yeah, yeah, like Tesla, one of those kind of guys that just can see things in a way that no one else can see around corners. Amazing. Well, I can't wait to see that. And I absolutely loved First Reformed. I can't recommend it enough. It's out in theaters beginning May 18th. Ethan Hawke, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Ethan Hawke for coming on the podcast. Catch his brilliant performance in First Reformed, now playing in theaters. Check your local listings for showtimes. I also want to remind you to check out adiamore.com/kick for a huge selection of diamonds and jewelry. When I recently decided to pop the question, I shopped around, but no one beat adiamore.com for the best price and the very best quality. All of adiamore's diamonds are GIA certified, and their rings come with a lifetime guarantee against material defects. Plus, adiamore gives you 30 days to evaluate the deal and make sure that you're 100% happy with your purchase. That's because the folks at adiamore know that once you find a jeweler you can trust, you've got a jeweler for life and you'll keep coming back year after year. So do yourself a favor. If you're shopping for an engagement ring or a gift, even if you think you're going to go somewhere else, before you make that big decision, you owe it to yourself to click on adiamore.com/kick, look at their selection and compare. That's adiamore.com/kick, adiamore.com/kick. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.